And Lee continued to nod. After half an hour of hearing Mukhtar talking out of his ass, Lee hired him as a junior sales associate. Mukhtar was 19 years old. He brought a dozen brochures home, studied the various models and features, and came back feeling invincible. Now that Mukhtar was working there, Lee shifted into a different man, not the guy who had interviewed him. That guy had been so gentle. He'd spoken with a small and delicate voice, strange coming out of his square jaw and thick neck. But that was Lee's way during interviews, and with customers, too. His voice tiptoed around, his smile was kind, his posture relaxed. But off hours, behind closed doors, talking about quotas, moving inventory, Lee was a Marine. "You gotta control the motherfucking conversation, Mo. Don't let those fuckers get control. Don't let those fuckers get control. Whoever controls the conversation controls the deal. You got that?" Mukhtar couldn't argue. The guy was about a buck 90 and cut like a statue. So Mukhtar tried to control the conversation. Ask them questions. Questions they have to say yes to, Lee said. "Get him saying yes. Get him fucking saying yes. You understand?" Mukhtar understood. He'd see a prospect on the lot, a middle-aged guy wearing a 49ers hat. He'd saunter up. "You like the 49ers this year?" "Sure." "That Justin Smith, he's a beast, right?"
"He is."
"And Frank Gore, that guy's a tank. Plays the game how it should be played."
"Right."
"Now look at the car, a black Accord, keep the yeses coming." "You like this car?"
"Sure."
"You like this color?"
"Yeah."
"Can't beat black. Always looks good, day or night. You want to get inside?"
"Sure."
"You like the dash?"
"Yeah."
"You like the leather?"
"I do."
"Check out the digital speedometer. You like that?"
"I do."
"Check out this sound system. You like Tupac? Coldplay?"
"Coldplay."
"Me too. You see that concert last year? At Shoreline? Oh, and check out the GPS. You like it?"
"Yeah."
"You want to take it for a drive?"
"Sure."
"You like the acceleration?"
"Yeah."
"You like the steering?"
"Yeah."
"The cornering?"
"Sure."
"The digital speedometer?"
"Yeah."
"If we get the right price for you, you think you want to drive this baby home today?" After the test drive, it was up to Lee. That was the arrangement. Lee had decided that Mukhtar would be the young car guy, the young upstart who knew cars, loved cars, but didn't know prices. The numbers weren't his forte. So Mukhtar would grab a prospect, get them excited about the car, just one car lover to another, doing the test drive, cranking some jams, cruising around south of Market, sweet. Then he'd bring them back to the office, and Lee would step in. The second month, Mukhtar sold 2 cars. The third month, 9. Soon, Lee let him deal with the numbers, make the offers. First, Mukhtar had to learn how to size people up. He knew clothes, knew when someone could afford a nice shirt, nice shoes. The shoes were key, but sometimes deceptive. The tech people all wore sneakers, and sneakers had a low ceiling. But he learned how it worked. Some of the wealthiest people liked simple cars and paid cash. The aspirational types wanted the car loaded with extras, and they liked the finance. Either way, the price could be massaged. There were 4 boxes, total price, interest rate, monthly payments, and down payment. And you could toggle each one till you got the price you needed. But first was the offer, the base number, and how that number was delivered was everything. "Make an offer and shut up," Lee said. "You make the offer and whoever speaks first loses. You got that? Whoever fucking talks next loses." Mukhtar would say a number, 32,500, and stare at the customer sitting on the other side of the desk. Just stare. Nothing bizarre. He wasn't trying to hypnotize anyone, but you had to be confident in that number. The number was the number. It was the best number you could do. And always, the customer would speak first. Always. "You let that fucker talk first, you hear me? Whoever fucking talks first loses." After a while, Mukhtar was averaging 12 cars a month and was pulling down $3,000 a month in commissions. He bought himself new clothes and new shoes. He gave the rest to his parents. They were proud and saw no reason for him to deviate from that course. Selling cars, it was more than he'd make working behind the counter at any of the Yemeni corner stores. More than he'd make pushing a mop. But after a year, Mukhtar felt an itch. He wanted something else, something more. A few of his friends were going to college or were already in college, and he was thinking of making a move. Maybe he was just looking for an excuse. There was an old man on the lot, impossibly old. Mokhtar couldn't understand how the old man had driven his way to the lot, had gotten out, and was walking around. He looked at least 90. Mokhtar made his way over to him, and the closer he got, the older the man seemed. 110, easy. He was dressed in an old man way, and he wanted a new car. He wanted to trade in his Chevy station wagon for an Accord, he said, but he didn't like the Accord's sticker price. Mokhtar had been told about these men, the ones who had read some Consumer Reports article or something on the Internet and came to the dealership with some arbitrary price in mind. This price was never the sticker price. It was always some number below the sticker price. Sometimes it was $500 under, sometimes it was $1,500. Usually it was $1,000. That was the standard number. They wanted $1,000 off whatever the sticker price said, and this old man was no different. He told Mokhtar he wanted the car, but wanted $1,000 knocked off. Mokhtar told the old man he'd check with his manager, and he went inside to see Lee.
Sure,
Lee said. Let's get the paperwork written up. Mokhtar went back outside and told the old man that they had a deal. They'd knock $1,000 off the sticker price. The man was elated, and they shook hands, and Mokhtar brought him inside and introduced him to Lee.
I'll take it from here,
Lee said, and Mokhtar went back to the lot. An hour later, Mokhtar watched the old man drive off in his new Accord, and he waved to the old man, thinking that something good had been done that day. He was impressed by Lee, by the way a brutal negotiator could show a certain respect, a certain mercy for an old man, call a ceasefire that day in the endless commission skirmishes, and go ahead and just knock $1,000 off. The old man only had so much time left on the planet. The hassle wasn't worth it.
That was cool of you, Mokhtar told Lee.
Lee looked at Mokhtar funny and pointed to the contract. The numbers were the usual garble of add-ons and fees and other nonsense, and Mokhtar realized Lee hadn't knocked off anything. The car cost the old man exactly what Lee wanted to charge him. He'd taken $1,000 off the initial number, but he'd added it right back on. That made it easier to leave. Mokhtar had been a part of 100 deals before, and there was always some number juggling. But this was different. Mokhtar went home that day, and a few days later he resigned via text. He knew it was unprofessional and that it spoke to the declining standards of propriety and workplace decorum. But he was done. That's what he wrote to Lee in his text. Just 3 words. I'm done, son. Chapter 8. Richgrove Agonists. Bakersfield is not high on the list of places a young man might go to begin his hero's journey. But Mokhtar's grandmother, Sitter, his mother's mother, lived in nearby Richgrove, and she had a couch. Mokhtar planned to sleep on this couch, rent-free, while he took classes at Bakersfield College. He needed time to concentrate on school without spending money, so he took a bus 4 hours downstate. It was not entirely his choice. His father, Faisal, was not happy about him quitting the Honda job. The way Faisal saw it, Mokhtar was well paid there, had a future there, and he quit for no significant reason. It was further evidence of a restless or even shiftless disposition. Mokhtar's parents wanted to know that Mokhtar had a plan. Either get and keep a job, they said, or go to college. Quitting good jobs while continuing to sleep on their floor was not a tenable option.
Leave down here for a while, his grandmother said. Take some classes.
Mokhtar needed some air, a change of pace. He packed his stuff and enrolled in 4 courses, political science, world history, sociology, and film studies. He moved into Sitter's house, just behind the Fastway Gas and Grocery on 99 South. Sitter and her husband Ali had purchased the Fastway back in the 1980s. The business was in the middle of the Central Valley, surrounded by fruit farms. Grapes across the highway, avocados and almonds down the road. When Sitter and Ali took over, it was the only gas station for miles, and it was instantly profitable. For the fruit pickers, almost all of them from Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America, Fastway was the place they'd buy lunch, buy beer for after work, gas for their trucks. The fuel never made a profit. No gas station can turn much of a profit on actual gas, but it brought people into the grocery, and that's where the profits happened. Food, lottery tickets, liquor. Ali and Sitter built a compound behind the station and lived there, happily, for 25 years.
Their kids, and now grandkids, were brought up working at the store, speaking Arabic at home, English in school, Spanish in the grocery. Mokhtar had been going downstate to visit since his family had moved to California. It was a rural life, quiet and dry and hot. On the narrow roads cut between fields of plums and grapes, his uncles Rakan and Rafiq had taught him to drive. And because in Yemen, basic facility with a rifle was expected of any young man, they took him to the Five Dogs range to teach him how to shoot. When Mokhtar arrived this time, his grandfather, Ali, had been dead 10 years. But the business was still thriving, still owned by Sitter and run by Rakan and her son-in-law, Taj. Taj and his wife, Andrea, lived with their 4 kids in the compound, too. It was crowded, but they made room for Mokhtar. He slept on the couch for the first month or so, until Rakan found and resurrected an old bed frame from the garage. It had been used, years before, by Andrea's daughter, Kitam. It was pink, but he was grateful, and he tried to be useful at the fast way. He took out the garbage. He broke down cardboard boxes. He helped out Olga, the sharp-tongued Mexican-American cook who made burritos and empanadas and sandwiches for the farm workers. The laborers who came to the fast way would give Sitter boxes of grapes, oranges, plums, blueberries, and almonds, whatever was in season, and Sitter would give them the herbs, spices, and figs she grew in the compound. Sitter loved Richgrove. It reminded her of Yemen, the warm and fertile Yemen she'd known as a girl. Everything grew in Ibe, she told Mokhtar. Melons, figs, lemons, apples, almonds, anything. Their Yemeni ancestors had been farmers in their native province of Ibe, so it made sense that Yemenis from Ibe came to California. It was where she was meant to live. Sitter had known Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. She'd known Naji Defala, a Yemeni-American farm worker and a martyr to the farm workers' cause. When Cesar Chavez began to organize farm workers, the Yemenis in the Central Valley lined up behind him. In 1973, Defala, a Yemeni from Ibe, became a United Farm Workers strike captain. Fluent in English and Spanish, he was a crucial link between the Spanish and Arabic-speaking laborers. In August that year, at the height of the UFW battles with the farm owners and law enforcement, Defala was outside a bar, celebrating a modest union victory. A Kern County police officer approached, and he and Defala had words. He beat Defala over the head with a flashlight and dragged him through the street, killing him. Chavez himself led the funeral procession, 7,000 farm workers strong, through Delano. Now, Mokhtar was going to college with the sons and daughters of those farm workers. His classes at Bakersfield College were decent, but he was soon bored. To some residents of Richgrove, Bakersfield was the big city, but Mokhtar found nothing to do in Bakersfield. He had no car and no spending money. He didn't connect with the other students. There was a Persian woman in his sociology class he found intriguing, and there were a few Muslim women who found him intriguing, but otherwise he quickly realized Bakersfield was not his destiny. After a semester, he was gone. He moved back in with his parents, who now lived on Treasure Island, a few blocks from where he'd gone to middle school. They were unhappy with him. He'd quit his Honda job. He'd quit college. Now he was sleeping on their floor. But there was hope in Yemen. It was 2011, and Yemen was swept up in the catapulting hopes of the Arab Spring. And Mokhtar joined the Yemeni-American community in the Bay Area to celebrate the progress made and to try to articulate the possibilities at hand. In April, Mokhtar and a group of other young Yemeni-Americans organized a march, and 2,000 Yemeni-Americans demonstrated in San Francisco to support Yemeni's push for democratic change. Shortly after, he was part of a national delegation of Yemeni-Americans invited to Washington, D.C. to address the State Department and the White House. Mokhtar was 21 years old, the youngest of the delegation, comprising 19 representatives from 11 states, and he had nothing to wear. He had owned one suit in his life, and he'd worn it through. Mohammed Mugheli, the imam from the 7th Street Mosque in Oakland, brought him to Men's Warehouse and hooked him up. Mokhtar had no funds for the flight to D.C., so Mugheli and a group of activists paid for that, too. Mokhtar showed up at the San Jose airport at 6 a.m., only to find that Mugheli, a novice at online ticketing, had booked Mokhtar's ticket from San Jose, Costa Rica, not San Jose, California. The airline took pity on him, and he was in D.C. that night. The next day, the delegation, they called themselves Yemenis for Change, addressed the State Department, outlining what they saw as the traditional pair of choices for Arab countries in the Middle East: military dictatorship, Libya, Iraq, Egypt, or right-wing theocracy, Iran, Saudi Arabia. Their presentation was called The Third Option, and pointed to Cairo's Tahrir Square, to the tens of thousands of young Egyptian activists who wanted democracy, who harbored no ill will toward the West, who wanted a self-determining nation based on a constitution, a new constitution, and the rule of law. The State Department people were politely intrigued. Then the delegation made a request. The United States had to stop supporting Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of Yemen, to whom they were funneling $200 million in weapons that year. The State Department people were nonplussed, but the delegation was invited to the White House, where they gave pretty much the same presentation to a small group of President Obama's foreign policy advisors. The results were unclear, but the delegation left Pennsylvania Avenue feeling heard and gratified, and Mokhtar and two other delegation members, Mugheli and Hisham Hussein, a chemical engineer from California, went on to the Lincoln Memorial. "See what you can have in Yemen?" Hussein said. He was standing at the foot of the monument, talking into a video camera. He was making a video message for the protesters in Sana'a. He hoped the video would inspire them. "Wouldn't you like this kind of freedom in Yemen?" he asked the camera, explaining the work of the delegation, that they'd had audiences at the State Department and White House that day. Mokhtar was feeling well pleased. The United States could make terrible mistakes abroad, and particularly in the Middle East, and the matter of the drone strikes was one that the delegation couldn't agree on how to address. But at the same time, there was a certain openness, the ability to say anything you wanted. That was real. And as an American, he felt proud of it. And then, out of the corner of his eye, he saw a uniformed man moving toward them. The man was wearing blue and had a badge. "Please, no," Mokhtar thought. "Excuse me," the man said. He was pink-faced and smiling. "Hi there. How you guys doing?" Mokhtar, using his most American English, said they were doing fine. He had a sense where this was headed, but prayed he was wrong. What language were you guys speaking there?" the officer asked. Mokhtar looked closely at his badge. He wasn't D.C. police. He was something else. Not Secret Service, but some kind of police force dedicated to the monuments. Mokhtar told him they had been speaking Arabic.
"Arabic, huh?"
the officer said, and his eyes seemed to register, for a moment, that he was onto something potentially serious.
"You mind if I see your IDs?"
By now, Hussein had stopped videotaping. They handed the officer their IDs, and the officer jogged down the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to a black car. Mokhtar assumed he was running their names through a database of terror suspects. By now, most of the people visiting the monument were watching the events, stealing glances at Mokhtar's trio. Some tourists had made a quick exit, possibly thinking some violence was about to erupt between law enforcement and a group of extremists. Mokhtar thought of his father, who was already on some kind of registry, he was sure. Just a few years earlier, Faisal and Bushra had been driving through Treasure Island looking at potential homes to rent when they were pulled over by police. Someone had seen them driving around the island, Bushra wearing a hijab, and thought they might be casing the area for a potential terrorist strike. Faisal and Bushra had received a kind of apology eventually, but Mokhtar had no doubt that their names, and perhaps his, were on some shadowy database, never to be purged. 15 minutes later, the officer returned to the feet of Lincoln.
"Sorry about that," he said. "You're free to go. Or stay."
Now, though Mokhtar knew it wasn't a good idea to escalate any of this, or even extend it a minute into the unknown, he couldn't help it. "Officer," he said, "what if I told you that I'm an American citizen and that we just came back from the State Department and the White House, where we were asked to speak, and after a day speaking to important people and feeling good about our democracy, now this will be my experience in D.C.? Because that's what just happened. If Lincoln were alive, what would he say?" Mokhtar went on this way for a while, until the officer's face seemed to soften. His eyes weren't the eyes of a zealot or an ignorant man. They were the eyes of a man acting on orders and with limited information.
"Well, I'm sorry,"
the man said. He apologized a few more times and seemed to actually mean it. He jogged down the steps and back into the car, and the car rolled away. Chapter 9. The Button. For the next few years, Mokhtar had no plan. He slept on the floor of his parents' Treasure Island home and worked temp jobs. He spent time at UC Berkeley, helping organize students around causes crucial to Arab and Muslim Americans. He spent so much time there that most of the students, Ibrahim Ahmed Ibrahim among them, assumed he was enrolled. But he wasn't taking classes there, or anywhere. He watched his peers become sophomores, juniors, seniors. He watched them graduate. He watched Miriam graduate. He lost years to indecision, to inaction. For a while, he worked for Omar Ghazali, a prosperous fruit broker. Omar had grown up in Yemen and came to the United States in 2004 with nothing and with no particular plan in mind. He drove a taxi for a while, then worked as a security guard, then a valet, and finally tried his hand at buying and distributing California produce. He bought from the Central Valley and sold to San Francisco. Soon, most of the fruit available in Chinatown came through him. The mission, too. If someone needed 10,000 oranges by the next afternoon, he could get them. 10 tons of Stockton cherries overnight, he could make that happen. He grew a tiny business into a multi-million-dollar operation. He gave Mokhtar a job in the Oakland warehouse, loading trucks. Sometimes Mokhtar made deliveries. He called delinquent accounts. He learned that the best California cherries were exported to Japan and could bring as much as $1 for each cherry. He learned that it mattered which farm produce came from, that an orange from Stockton tasted different from an orange from downstate. He learned, too, that Omar didn't really need him. He'd given him a job as a favor to a fellow Yemeni. And when Mokhtar had saved enough to pay for classes at City College, Mokhtar was free to go. Mokhtar took his savings and enrolled. Then Miriam gave him the satchel, and he bought the laptop with money borrowed from Walid. He raised money for Somali famine relief. Then he lost it. Omar loaned him the money to give to Islamic Relief, and now Mokhtar was $4,100 in debt. So he was a doorman, and every day he sat at his infinity desk, vibrating, thinking of time, slipping. Friends were going to graduate school. His younger brother, Walid, was about to graduate from UC Davis. Mokhtar was 25 and had 4 community college credits to his name. He was a doorman. A doorman listening to the inanities and vulgarities of the Infinity residence. A woman had recently spent 15 minutes on her phone in the lobby, engaged in a lewd sexual conversation. She knew he could hear. She was no more than 5 feet away. She didn't care, or found it entertaining, or alluring, to talk graphically in front of him. Was she worse or better than the resident who made a point to tell him about the $80,000 worth of china she'd had delivered? Why did he need to know that? At the holidays, she gave him $20 and a cookie. But he was thankful for the paycheck. Thankful to be working in a clean and safe place, in a job that was not difficult or dangerous. He had friends in jail. He had friends working in tenderloin corner stores, shotguns within reach. And Ali Shaheen, the kid from the Toucans tutoring program, the son of the imam, was dead. He'd gone to Mecca, and within weeks of returning to San Francisco, he was found near Candlestick Park, shot 5 times in the head. No one knew who did it, or why. Mokhtar sat at his infinity desk, knowing that could have been him. He and Ali knew all the same people, had seen the same things, were seduced by the same temptations. Mokhtar, alive and safe in the infinity, felt grateful. But he wanted more. He just didn't know what. Justin wanted to be an olive importer. Justin Chen was a friend Mokhtar had made at UC Berkeley, one of the many students there who assumed Mokhtar was enrolled. Every so often, Justin would come by and sit on the infinity lobby's white leather couch, Maria didn't allow lobby ambassadors to visit with friends, but Justin could pass for a bike messenger. And he and Mokhtar could kill half an hour, Mokhtar hovering between the desk and the front door in his blue suit, opening the infinity doors, while Justin talked about olive oil. Justin was finishing up his degree in peace and conflict studies, but what he really wanted to do was grow olives. Mokhtar listened, half amused and half exasperated. What did Justin know about olive oil? Justin wanted to buy land in California, grow olives, package olive oil. Specialty olive oil, he said. He studied the supply chain and had ideas for improvements. Mokhtar didn't know what to say. Justin had no family in farming in California. Why olives? Hadn't he wanted to be a cop at one point? And where would he get the money for an olive farm? Sometimes Miriam came by. Miriam had finished college and was helping out at her parents' deli south of Market. Sometimes she made deliveries for the deli, and when the deliveries were at or near the Infinity, she'd stay with Mokhtar and pass the time until Maria came around. Their romance lasted a year, maybe less. There were the obvious obstacles. Mokhtar was from a conservative Yemeni family, the Yemenis being the most insular of Arab communities. It was almost unheard of for a Yemeni American to marry outside the community. Most of Mokhtar's Yemeni friends, male and female, had entered into arranged unions with Yemenis from the homeland. That was the standard. You go back to Yemen, marry whomever your parents set you up with, natives of Ib or Sana'a or Aden, the two families going back centuries together. Rare were the instances of Yemeni Americans meeting and marrying other Yemeni Americans. And unheard of was any Yemeni American man marrying a woman whose mother was Palestinian and whose father was a Greek-American Jerry Garcia devotee, and both Christian. It was impossible. So Mokhtar and Miriam had been careful. They went into it slowly, chastely, always on the lookout for Mokhtar's dad, circling the city in his bus. When after weeks of flirtation they finally admitted to each other that their feelings were romantic, they spent all night walking the city, and at last made their way to Ocean Beach, where Mokhtar had long wanted to take her. The night was clear, the sand was warm from a day of sun, and all was good until it was 3 a.m., and they were waiting for the bus home. As it approached, Mokhtar remembered, how could he have forgotten, that they were on his father's line, the Five Fulton, and if he caught them together, there would be formidable woe. So they ran from the bus stop and walked the many miles till she was home. Now their friendship was more important to Mokhtar. Miriam was a fighter, and he wanted to be a fighter, too. She fought for him. She fought for every injustice. She was outraged about Palestine, and outraged about the immigration policies of the U.S. State Department. She encouraged Mokhtar to be vocal, to be involved. She had no fear. Any wrong, local or global, only emboldened her. It was stasis and silence that she couldn't stand, and every time he saw her, as they sat in the Infinity lobby talking about dreams or dreams deferred, he felt stronger, more inspired, and worse about his current life, opening the doors for wealthy strangers. Especially given the existence of the button. It was right next to the phone and had been there all along. When he pushed it, the two glass doors 22 feet away opened. The system was quick, quiet, elegant. Using the button, Mokhtar could see a guest coming down the sidewalk and have those doors wide open and ready by the time they arrived. Even better, the button opened both doors. By hand, Mokhtar couldn't open both doors. They were too heavy and too big. With the button, though, the resident could stride through a fantastically wide and welcoming gateway of glass, unobstructed. They could enter the lobby, and Mokhtar, the lobby ambassador, could greet them. He'd be happy to greet them. It cost him nothing to look up and say hello. But to leap from the desk, to rush over, eager and panting, only to push open a door that could be opened with a button? It was a self-evident outrage and an assault on his pride. Especially when the residents passed through the lobby, entered the elevators, and flew up to apartments high above him, places he'd never seen. Book 2 Chapter 10 The Statue. Miriam texted one day. "You ever look across the street?" she asked. Mokhtar didn't know what she was talking about. Across the street, there's a statue of a Yemeni dude drinking a big cup of coffee, she told him.
She just made a delivery from her dad's deli to the building across the street from the Infinity, and in the courtyard, she saw an enormous statue of a man in a thobe with a giant mug lifted to his lips.
That's got to mean something, she said. Maybe this is your thing.
What she meant was,
you're 25, Mokhtar. Pick a direction for your life.
He'd been working 120 feet away from this statue, but he'd never seen it.
It was enormous, about 20 feet tall.
The man was in mid-stride, drinking from a giant coffee cup. Mokhtar wasn't sure about its historical accuracy. The man seemed to be some mashup of Ethiopian and Yemeni. And why were there cute little flowers all over his thobe? It looked like he was wearing a shower curtain or muumuu. No self-respecting Arab would be wearing flowers all over his thobe. But Mokhtar walked into the building, into the lobby across the street from his own lobby, and an encompassing history of coffee in the United States was presented in framed photos and captions. The building had been built by the Hills brothers, Austin and R.W., who in the late 1800s set up a coffee importing business called Arabian Coffee and Spice Mills. The brothers brought beans to California from around the world and roasted them for distribution all over the West. But freshness was a challenge. Every day, on oceans or rails or roads, the coffee grew staler. This changed in 1900, when R.W. stumbled upon a way to remove the air from packaging. This became known as vacuum packing, and kept coffee beans fresher for longer, and soon revolutionized the business of coffee. The Hills brothers became phenomenally successful, and were instrumental in popularizing coffee in the United States. The graphic version of the statue became their well-known logo, and the company thrived independently for 100 years. Eventually, long after the brothers died and ceded the company to descendants and strangers, Hills Brothers was sold to Nestle, who sold it to Sara Lee, who sold it to Massimo Zanetti Beverage, USA. The company left San Francisco in 1997, moving its headquarters downstate to Glendale. But the statue remained, and Mokhtar left the courtyard in a daze. Coffee and Yemen. Some ghost of a memory passed through him. That night on Treasure Island, he mentioned the statue to his mother. She laughed.
We've had coffee in our family for hundreds of years, she said. Don't you remember your grandfather's house in Ibe? He had coffee trees in his yard. He's still got them. Don't you know Yemenis were the first to export coffee? Yemenis basically invented coffee. You didn't know this?
Mokhtar went on a research binge. At home, on his phone, he dove in and quickly encountered a long-running debate about the origins of coffee and the dual claims between Ethiopia and Yemen to its discovery. There was widespread agreement that the earliest origin myth involved an Ethiopian shepherd named Kaldi. Apparently, Kaldi was far afield with his sheep, allowing them to graze on any vegetation they could find. Every night he slept near them, and all was peaceful until late one night, when he expected them to be resting, he found that his sheep were still up and about. More than up and about. They were jumping, prancing, braying. Kaldi was mystified. He thought they might be possessed. But soon it became clear that they'd been eating beans from the bushes nearby. These were coffee beans. And when Kaldi ate the beans himself, they had the same effect on him. He was shot through with new vigor and mental acuity. He had discovered the coffee bean.
Wait, no. Not coffee beans, Mokhtar noted. The goats had been eating coffee fruit.
Coffee beans were inside the coffee fruit, which grew on lush green bushes. At its most ripe, the coffee fruit was red and looked like a grape. Mokhtar saw the photos online, piles of red cherries like huge ruby-red beads. Coffee was a fruit. Mokhtar remembered this, plucking red cherries from a small tree in his grandfather's garden. The cherry could be eaten. He remembered eating the flesh of the fruit, which was sweet, and then spitting out the seeds. The seeds were the coffee. It all made sense now. Coffee was a fruit from a tree. A tree that usually bloomed once a year, and inside each fruit was the coffee bean. And the two halves of the bean were what we typically saw, the tiny bean, oval, and with a stripe of concavity down the middle. two halves of a bean wrapped inside a fleshy fruit the size of a grape. But first the bean had to be separated from the fruit. There was the red skin, then the white flesh. Then, attached to the beans, was the mucilage, and then the silver skin. The bean inside was green, sometimes yellow, and hard like any seed. A coffee tree could be grown from any unroasted coffee bean. Of course. Did anyone know this? Or remember this? If Mokhtar didn't know any of this, who did? And who knew about the Yemeni role in it all? Few knew coffee had been born in Arabia. There were two kinds of coffee, Robusta and Arabica. But it was Arabica that was considered far superior in taste. And it was called Arabica because it was born in Arabia, specifically in what the Romans had called Arabia Felix, Happy Arabia. This was Yemen. According to legend, it was in Mocha, a port city on the Yemeni coast, that the bean was first brewed. For centuries after Kaldi, the shepherd, had come and gone, Ethiopians chewed the beans and made weak tea from them. But it was Ali ibn Omar al-Shadli, a Sufi holy man living in Mocha, who first brewed the bean into a semblance of what we now recognize as coffee, then known as qahwa. He and his fellow Sufi monks used the beverage in their ceremonies celebrating God, which lasted long into the night. The coffee helped bring them to a kind of religious ecstasy. And because the Sufis were travelers, they brought coffee to all corners of North Africa and the Middle East. The Turks turned kahwa into kahfe, which became, in other languages, coffee. Al-Shadli became known as the Monk of Mocha, and Mocha became the primary point of departure for all the coffee grown in Yemen and destined for faraway markets. Mocha itself was a barren and dry coastal area, not suited for coffee cultivation. But nevertheless, the word Mocha became synonymous with coffee. The coffee was grown in the interior of the country, in the mountains, using ingenious irrigation and terraces. The cherries were brought to Mocha for processing and export, and Mocha became a thriving commercial center, not just for coffee, but for other fruits and goods, too. But coffee drove trade traffic to the port and was considered so valuable that exporting coffee plants was a crime. Men had been arrested and executed for the high treason of trying to leave port with a seedling. The first coffee houses, called Café Kane, appeared throughout Arabia and were known for lively discussions, for music, and in some cases, activities frowned upon in various quarters, prostitution, gambling, and criticism of the local government. Coffee houses were often closed by rulers who saw in them the beginnings of uprisings. In 1511, Kher Bey, then the governor of Mecca, got wind that verses lampooning him had originated at coffee houses, so he decreed that all coffee houses be closed. But the ban didn't last long. The demand was too great. Who knew all this? Mokhtar wondered. He could ask anyone on the street where coffee had been born, and they might say Paris, they might say Africa, they might say Colombia or Java. But who would say Yemen? What the world knew about Yemen now was terrorism and drones. Since the bombing of the USS Cole off the coast of Aden, Mokhtar had seen his parents' country devolve from Happy Arabia to what some considered one of the world's most menacing places, home to burgeoning Al-Qaeda and ISIS cells, and the relentless American drone strikes meant to neutralize those threats. And the coffee trade in Yemen was all but finished. Though Ethiopia had been home to the first coffee bush, and Yemen home to the first cultivation and organized coffee trade, in the last 50 years, Ethiopia had come to dominate the region. Ethiopia was now the fourth largest producer in the world, while Yemen was all but forgotten, its exports negligible, and considered of wildly unpredictable quality. In the mid-1800s, Yemen exported 75,000 tons of coffee a year, and by the 21st century, produced only 11,000. And only about 4% of that was specialty coffee quality. And beyond the quality issues, Yemen was far more difficult for Western travelers. The mountainous coffee-growing regions were informally governed by local tribes and militias, whose movements were generally precarious for visitors, exporters, anyone. Given the choice between trading with Ethiopians and the Yemenis, most coffee specialists found Ethiopia a far easier and safer bet. The second factor
was Kat. Mokhtar knew Kat, enjoyed Kat. Kat was illegal in the United States, but in Yemen, it was a central part of daily life for virtually every man. A long leaf that, when chewed in significant quantities, provided a mild narcotic effect, Kat grew in similar climates to coffee, but was far more profitable. The incentive, then, for any Yemeni farmer to grow coffee was negligible. Most of it was exported to Saudi Arabia for a middling profit, while Kat garnered higher prices and was sold locally. Given the realities of the market, coffee had been relegated to a relatively small group of passionate but ill-trained Yemeni farmers. The training was the last and most important factor. Because it wasn't profitable for most farmers, the careful processes for the cultivation and harvesting of high-quality coffee in Yemen had been long lost. Now, it was picked and stored without great care, and Yemeni coffee, though it was the world's first ever cultivated, was known to be inferior to most or all other coffees in the world. Chapter 11. The Plan. Part 1. Mokhtar was grateful to Miriam and thanked her by boring her, and Justin and Jeremy and his family on Treasure Island with daily breathless updates about his plans to become a coffee importer. He put it all down on paper. Not regular paper. He used a large roll of white paper, the kind usually hung from an easel, and he carried this roll of white paper around every day for months, recording notes and plans and unrolling it for his friends, explaining not just the history of Yemeni coffee, but his role in resurrecting it. He started with a SWOT chart. Any serious endeavor in 2013 started with a SWOT chart. Under strengths, he wrote, highest amount of coffee genetic diversity, ideal microclimate, highest elevation, historical significance. Under weaknesses, he wrote, no infrastructure, lack of data, lots of defects, no traceability. For opportunities, he wrote, historical significance, no one else focused on specialty coffee in Yemen, finding and reviving ancient varietals. For threats, he wrote, Al-Qaeda, corrupt government, pirates in Red Sea, tribal violence, Andrew Nicholson? Who was this Andrew Nicholson? Every time Mokhtar looked into coffee in Yemen, he ran across this name, Andrew Nicholson. Apparently, he was an American from Louisiana who had, for whatever reason, moved to Yemen, to the capital, Sana'a, and started to export Yemeni coffee under the name Rayan, Arabic for the Gate of Paradise. Nicholson seemed to occupy the territory Mokhtar hoped to inhabit. But having another American in the business, in Sana'a, might be enormously helpful. Economies of scale, sharing contacts, resources, camaraderie. This is it, he told Miriam. I will resurrect the art of Yemeni coffee and restore it to prominence throughout the world. Oh, Jesus, Miriam thought. But she was supportive. Everyone was supportive. Mokhtar's friend Giuliano was especially on board. Mokhtar had met Giuliano during his freshman year. Giuliano was a unicorn, a teenager who'd converted to Islam on his own. He'd been brought up in an Italian Catholic family in North Beach by divorced parents. There wasn't much money, but the family was content, and Giuliano was a happy and curious child. His parents were greatly confused, but ultimately unsurprised, when their only son told them he was converting to Islam. He was 15, and had learned most of what he knew about the faith by reading Islam for Dummies. His attraction to the religion started a few years earlier, when people started assuming he was an Arab. You look Muslim, they'd tell him. You an Arab? Arabic speakers would greet him with an earnest or offhand salam alaikum. Finally, Giuliano looked in the mirror to get a sense of what they were seeing. There's something there, he thought. Maybe I do look Middle Eastern. That was the beginning of it, the strange catalyst for his entry to Islam. In a roundabout way, he became a Muslim because so many people assumed he was a Muslim. So he studied Islam and converted himself. Islam allows a follower to self-declare adherence to the faith, to become a Muslim by personal commitment, without any formal ceremony. So one day, he declared himself a Muslim and spent his first Ramadan at Burger King. Islam was only one point of Giuliano's connection with Mokhtar, though. As high school students, Neither had much money to spend, so they found in each other a common ability to find free entertainment in the city. They would go to the wharf to hassle tourists. They would look for dropped dollars. But mostly, they talked about books and food. Giuliano, raised by Italian parents, knew food and would bring Mokhtar home for homemade risotto. They talked Herodotus and Edward Said and pretend they understood Plato's Republic. Mokhtar and Giuliano were autodidacts, and through food were awakened to heretofore unknown parts of the world and history. They go to Giuliano's father's restaurant. He owned one briefly, Michelangelo's Cafe. It failed, and he went back to work as a waiter. And on the menu, they saw sun-dried prunes, and that would be the impetus for research. Where were sun-dried prunes grown? Tuscany? Was that in France or Italy? They taught themselves history, philosophy, and, left unsupervised for long stretches, they grew up quickly. When he was 19, Giuliano fell in love with a Pakistani-American woman named Benish. She was brown-eyed and beautiful, also a San Francisco native. They'd met right after high school, and though they knew they wanted to be married, Giuliano knew his parents, and hers, would consider it too soon. Or worse, Giuliano assumed there would be some insurmountable cross-cultural divide. Would her Pakistani father allow his daughter to marry a 19-year-old Italian Muslim convert? Would there be serious trouble ahead? Some discussion of honor killing? Swimming in love, his mind went to some strange places. But Giuliano's parents readily acquiesced. And when Giuliano asked Benicia's father, he gave his consent and asked for grandchildren. Giuliano and Benicia were married at her home. Mokhtar brought frankincense and myrrh, and they moved into a North Beach flat. Their first child, Sauda, was born 3 years later. By then, Mokhtar was working at the Infinity, and Giuliano was driving for Uber. They would unwind after work by lifting weights at 24-hour fitness, and before the workout, they'd drink coffee. Giuliano had grown up around coffee and educated Mokhtar about how the Italians liked it, standing at the counter, sipping espresso, a little sugar. Never milk. He took Mokhtar to the new blue bottle coffee in the ferry building. This is the closest thing to a real Italian espresso, Giuliano told him, and they'd stand there, looking as Italian as they could while they downed two or three espressos to get themselves amped for heavy lifting. That blue bottle was a stone's throw from the Hills Brothers building, where coffee had been imported, roasted, and sent all over the western United States. The coincidences, Mokhtar felt, were adding up and making it ever more clear and irrefutable that this was destiny, that he had found his calling. No, it was more than a calling. Mokhtar referred to it as a mission in those early days, and he was careful not to say that he was being guided by God. But he believed this. He pictured himself careening through the Yemeni countryside, bringing knowledge and wealth to the farmers and leaving with beautiful red cherries for export. His new life would be one of planes and horses and ships, and his story could join the pantheon of coffee explorers, those who brought about the proliferation of coffee cultivation and the popularity of the beverage around the globe. As he'd been walking around with his SWAT scroll, he imagined himself as part of the historical continuum of coffee. A vivid timeline animated by a succession of rogue adventurers who also happened to be, almost without exception, thieves. First was Bada Budan, a Muslim holy man from the Chikmagalur district of Karnataka, India, in the 1500s. Budan went to Mecca to perform the Hajj. On the way back, traveling through Yemen, he encountered coffee, by then known as the wine of Islam. Enchanted, he wanted to bring it back to India, but this was not permitted. The Arabs would sell him as many roasted beans as he could buy and carry, but they wouldn't give him a seedling, not even a cherry. So he stole them. He strapped 7 cherries to his belly and wrapped his robe over them loosely, the folds hiding his treasure. In India, he planted the seeds in the Chandragiri Hills, and from those 7 cherries, millions of Arabica plants flourished. India now is the world's 6th largest coffee producer. And Baba Budan is considered a saint. The Dutch, too, wanted to leave Yemeni shores with a coffee plant. Coffee had first come to Europe in 1615, when it was exported from Mocha to Venice and used for medicinal purposes. Eventually, it was imbibed socially and proliferated throughout parts of Europe, with the Venetians holding a monopoly on trade with mocha. This didn't sit well with the Dutch, then a global power in naval trade. It was absurd that a commodity of this value was cultivated and controlled by so few in one small port in Arabia. So in 1616, a Dutchman named Peter Vandenbroek, who had visited mocha while working for the Dutch East India Company, successfully stole seedlings from mocha and secreted them to Holland, where they were installed at the Hortus Botanicus in Amsterdam. The seedlings took root in the garden, but the Dutch climate wasn't right for large-scale cultivation of the plant. It wasn't until 1658 that coffee was brought to the Dutch colony of Ceylon, and later to Java, also a Dutch territory, where it thrived. Java soon became the primary supplier of coffee to Europe, and mocha's primacy waned. The Dutch were as careful with their monopoly as the Yemenis had been, assiduously protecting the farms in Java, blocking any export of seedlings or cherries. For half a century, the Dutch enjoyed control of the European market, until the French entered the business via a bizarre act of economic self-harm on the part of the mayor of Amsterdam. In 1713, he presented King Louis XIV with a coffee plant. It was to be a gift, he insisted, not the beginning of an industry, and for years, the French observed this understanding, keeping the plant within the walls of the Jardin des Plantes in Paris. Visitors could admire the plant from a distance, and most did so without any thought of subterfuge or theft. A man named Gabriel Duclieu, though, had different plans. Duclieu was an officer in the French Navy and was determined to bring coffee to the West Indies, a French territory that was considered a suitable coffee-growing counterpart to Java. He set sail in 1723 on a corvette called the Dromedaire, but 2 weeks into the trip, his ship was attacked by pirates off the coast of Tunisia. The Dromedaire was well-armed, though, and with its 24 guns was able to repel the pirates. They were only a few hundred miles from Martinique when the ship was damaged by a storm and began to take on water. Cargo had to be jettisoned to prevent the Dromedaire from sinking, and among the jettisoned cargo was a good deal of the crew's drinking water. For the rest of the trip, water was strictly rationed, and Duclieu had to share his own small ration of water with the coffee plant, drop by drop. On Martinique, Duclieu planted his seedling, which begat hundreds more, which he distributed across the island. From there, coffee cultivation grew almost exponentially, replacing the island's previous cash crop, cocoa. Duclieu was a hero, and the French had a monopoly on coffee cultivation in the Western Hemisphere, for a time at least. Francisco de Meio Palheta was a lieutenant colonel in the Brazilian army, Brazil at the time still under Portuguese control. The Portuguese badly wanted in on the rapidly expanding market for coffee, and they saw Brazil as a perfect environment for growing the plants. But they had been unsuccessful in getting their hands on a seedling. By this time, the French were cultivating coffee not only in Martinique, but in French Guiana, too, and in 1727, that colony became embroiled in a border dispute with Dutch Guiana, the territory just over the Rio Oyapaki. To settle the matter, the two colonies asked the ostensibly impartial Brazilians to intercede, and Brazil sent Francisco de Meio Palheta. By then, Palheta was 57, but he was still a handsome and romantic man whose charms had certain effects on the women he encountered. He traveled to Cayenne, the capital of French Guiana, where he sat with the French and Dutch colonial governors and settled the question of the border. But that was not his primary goal. During his time in Cayenne, he was conspiring to get a seedling out of the country. The farms where the coffee plants were grown, though, were well guarded, and he was a known figure, so he couldn't be seen skulking around. Instead, he went about seducing the governor's wife, Marie-Claude Duvic de Pongibaud. She was so taken with him that at a state dinner held in his honor to thank him for brokering an agreement on the border, she provided him with a bouquet of flowers, inside of which she'd hidden enough coffee cherries to start a farm of his own. He planted the first coffee plants in the Pará region of Brazil, and within 7 years he had 1,000 bushes thriving. These plants became the foundation of the Brazilian coffee industry, which by 1840 accounted for 40% of the world's production. One of Brazil's largest markets was the burgeoning colonies of North America. The Dutch had introduced coffee there in the 1600s, and it was reasonably popular, always sharing primacy with tea. But as tensions grew between the colonists and the British crown, and as taxes on tea grew ever more onerous, the colonists began to see tea as emblematic of the British yoke. On December 16, 1773, hundreds of colonists, most of them dressed as Native Americans, met four ships of the British East India Company in Boston Harbor, and they dumped all the tea on board the ships into the sea. Tea drinking in the United States was never the same. Coffee became the stimulant of choice for the new nation, bought primarily from the Dutch, thus the moniker Java. Its popularity grew in spurts until the 20th century, when mass production, better storage and packing techniques, Hills Brothers being instrumental in much of this, and demand, wrought by World War I and World War II, all conspired to make the United States the world's leading coffee consumer. By the 21st century, Americans were consuming 25% of the world's coffee, and by 2014, coffee was one of the most valuable agricultural products in the world, a $70 billion business, with the cherries grown in Colombia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Kenya, Uganda, Guatemala, Mexico, Hawaii, Jamaica, and Ethiopia. But Yemen, the region that had started the cultivation of the coffee plant in the first place, was now a tiny and largely ignored player in the world coffee market. Mokhtar had the idea that he could change that. But first, he had to seek a son to Ken. Chapter 12. Sage Advice from Ghassan Tukan. Part 2. Ghassan Tukan loomed large in Mokhtar's mind. With any talk of money or starting a business, he first thought of Ghassan. After his stint tutoring, or trying to tutor, the young Mokhtar Alkanshali, Ghassan went to San Jose State University, thinking he'd learn everything he needed to know to launch his own tech startup. But the pace was slow, and the professors at the time, most of them converted math professors, were out of step. They couldn't teach him what he wanted to know. Ghassan dropped out and started his own consulting business, building and improving computers for friends. Meanwhile, he worked at a cell phone shop in San Francisco, on Market Street. His parents expected their son to get an undergraduate degree, and perhaps a master's. They were aghast to see their dropout son working at a cell phone store on a shady block of mid-market. But Ghassan had designs. He and a friend built an e-commerce platform and created their own company, the LX Group. A few years later, it was acquired by NetSuite, the e-commerce behemoth, for a respectable sum. Ghassan was not yet a landed man of leisure, but he had done extraordinarily well, and Mokhtar had been paying attention. He and Ghassan had stayed in touch over the years, and now that Mokhtar had this coffee notion, he wanted to talk it over with the most successful entrepreneur he knew. They agreed to meet at Four Barrel Coffee in the Mission. Ghassan arrived first, expecting Mokhtar to be late. But Mokhtar was uncharacteristically on time. And he was carrying some kind of picture frame. Was he really carrying a picture frame? Ghassan wondered. He was. Mokhtar had brought a framed picture to the meeting. It was enormous. Check this out, Mokhtar said, and unveiled it. It was a reproduction of an English-language newspaper from 1836. On the front page, there was an engraving of the ancient port of Mocha. Mokhtar launched into a long and meandering monologue about coffee, Yemen, the port of Mocha, the two spellings. Which spelling did Ghassan like, by the way? M-O-C-H-A or M-O-K-H-A? How he discovered his connection to all this, and how he planned to become a coffee importer-exporter and revive the ancient art and prominence of coffee from his ancestral land. Ghassan didn't know what to say. Mokhtar was all over the map. "Do you have a business plan?" Ghassan asked. Mokhtar unveiled his business plan with the same flourish he'd given the framed newspaper. It was a stack of multicolored paper an inch thick, a bizarre combination of manifesto, history lesson, idea dump, and rant. "And this," Mokhtar said, pointing to a page full of bullet points. The bullet points alone, Mokhtar implied, made it a business plan, and made it a great one. Ghassan looked at it. He tried to read it. Finally, he took a breath and said, Mokhtar, I have to be honest with you. This is the ghettoest business plan I've ever seen. Still, he knew Mokhtar was onto something. He saw the passion in his eyes, on the pages. The business plan had to be rebuilt from the ground up, but there might be something there. They would have to change the name. The monk of Mocha was wrong with either.